Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Pope Francis has issued a new church law requiring Catholic priests and nuns around the world to report clergy sexual abuse or cover-ups to superiors within the church. But not everyone is convinced it will lead to real reform. Boston author and former priest James Carroll says, to save the church, dismantle the priesthood. Also today, Mayor Marty Walsh joins us to introduce Boston's incoming school superintendent, Brenda Caselius.
What Brenda's going to bring is a little different type of approach to the community and engaging people at the table out of the box.
I am a lifetime educator and have spent my life advocating for children and creating more equitable opportunities and working to build up communities.
And we'll take your calls. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. And we begin today with a drastic call to action in the Catholic Church from one of its own, author and former priest James Carroll. Carroll has a new article that appears in the June edition of The Atlantic. It's headlined, "To Save the Church, Dismantle the Priesthood." And James Carroll joins me now in studio. Jim, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Callum. Great to be back.
Let's just begin with that headline. It is really dramatic, as I said, to save the church, dismantle the priesthood. How did you arrive at that conclusion?
Well, it took me 20 years. It's almost 20 years since the Boston Globe Spotlight series began to run. 2002, was it? 10 years before that, the scandal began to brew in Boston with the revelations of an abusive priest named James Porter, which coincided, as it so happened, with my beginning as a columnist for the Globe, and I wrote about Porter. So that's almost 30 years, more than 25. For many, many years, I thought that this problem, the scandal laid bare by the abusive priests and the almost universal response of bishops to protect them instead of children, I thought it was an aberration, that the answer to it was to make certain reforms in the reporting procedures, for example, certain reforms in the way the church handled these accusations. But two things began to happen. One was, no matter how awful the revelations, as nation after nation after nation, wherever there were priests in the world, there were children being abused, priests being accused, and bishops protecting the priests instead of the children. This response became so consistent year in and year out that one began to realize there's something deeper going on here than simple abuse of minors and an institution that can't quite cope with it. There's some revelation of a basic dysfunction in the imagination of the church. And I came to the conclusion that that's centrally the problem and that it's embedded in the priesthood itself. Two things. It's all male character, which is an institutionalization of male supremacy, profoundly unjust rejection of the equality of women, a problem that looks different now than it did 20 years ago because the feminist revolution has matured to yet another important phase. And the second, the mandated requirement that all priests be celibate, which again isn't itself the issue, but it is a signal of a deeper disorder about the church's attitude towards sexuality generally. So what I'm really getting to is the deeper sources of the surface malfunction.
But couldn't you just – I mean, you've laid out – and I realize it's more complicated, but you've laid out two chief reforms. I mean, couldn't you just change those things, you know, allow women to become priests, allow priests to marry, as opposed to just tossing out the whole clerical structure?
Well, the question is, yes, that if that had been done 20 years ago – I'm quite sure the priesthood itself, but the church itself, would have evolved in ways that would have addressed this deeper dysfunction, which has to do with male supremacy and distrust of bodily experience, especially sexuality. So ordaining married people and ordaining women, admitting women to full equality in the church, would have had that kind of effect, I predict. I think it still would be – those are still ways to move forward. But the question became at a certain point, why isn't this happening? And then in 2013, Pope Francis is elected to the papacy, and it's universally understood that his major responsibility is to help the church begin a new day in relationship to the sex abuse scandal. And it seemed pretty obvious that the all-male, all-celibate character of the clergy was a place to begin. It turns out he's firmly defending both mandatory celibacy and an all-male priesthood. That's a revelation. Whoa, someone as revolutionary, as committed to change and as open-minded as Francis is not seeing the deeper disorder here. What is that telling us? Soon enough, it becomes pretty clear that there's a disorder in the institution itself. The priesthood is made up of countless men who are virtuous, generous, at the service of everyone in their lives. But the institution itself, the culture of the priesthood, is itself now deeply complicit in a pyramid of power that is showing itself to be incapable of reform. And that's the sad conclusion I've come to. And that's why I'm arguing that the deep dismantling of this structure of power is what's required. And the simple shorthand for where that begins is with the priesthood itself.
So you've been building toward this conclusion for a couple of decades now, at least, as you say.
Well, I didn't know it.
Yeah.
I didn't know it.
And you write, too, that it's sort of odd in a way that Pope Francis has played a role in triggering this, because you, like a lot of Catholics, I think, have placed a lot of hope in him as kind of a reforming figure. And I'm hoping that you can read a little bit from your Atlantic piece for us. This is a sort of particular line of questioning of Pope Francis in recent years that apparently really struck a chord with you. This is when he's been asked about the so-called Magdalene laundries in Ireland, right? These sort of homes for unwed mothers who we've learned through reporting over the years in some cases were forced to live out their lives in servitude. They were abused and mistreated. And that when the Pope was asked about that scandal, he said he'd never even heard about these Magdalene laundries.
Yes. I don't have it in front of me, but I think – let me just take a
– I can take it up for you, sir. There we go. We have it right in front of you, Jim. Sorry.
Sorry. Sorry. Well, the Pope said on the airplane going home from Ireland – and remember, Ireland is ground zero of this scandal.
Sure.
There are 18,000 identified victims of priests in Ireland, which means there are many more than that. Every person in Ireland is intimately related to a victim of a priest, which is why the Catholic Church has collapsed in Ireland. And the Magdalene laundries were a further instance of loss of faith in the church. When the Pope was asked about his attitude toward them, he said – he never heard of these mothers. He said they call them something like the laundromat of women. I never heard of these mothers. And that was the kind of tipping point for me, because at first I thought he's lying, which is a horrible thing to feel. But then I thought, well, maybe he's not lying. Maybe he's just ignorant. But to be ignorant of the Magdalene laundries, about which there have been reams written, plays produced, movies made, including Philomena starring Judi Dench, a kind of international scandal, hundreds of babies buried in sewage pits in the backyard of a convent, for goodness sake, laid bare by a government investigation, not by a church investigation, a kind of epitome of the moral degradation of the Catholic imagination. And when I read that the Pope claimed never to have heard of it, it just struck me as such an egregious instance of deflection and denial that I realized, of course, that characterizes the authorities, the Catholic authorities' overwhelming response to this whole problem, deflection and denial. And that's characterized even Francis, in whom we had placed such hope.
I think what stood out to me in that passage and why I wanted you to read it is, Picard's, you sort of pivot between, well, is it a lie or is it not a lie? But then you sort of hint at this idea that maybe it doesn't even really matter, that even if the Pope wasn't aware, he should have been, and that's just as bad,
right? It suggests such a level of detachment from the on-the-ground experience of the Catholic Church in Ireland. This is the Pope. It's not like he's the Archbishop of Chicago. Maybe the Archbishop of Chicago could be ignorant of such a scandal, but not the Pope. So either way, it was, as I write, a wire snapped in me, and I stopped being able to go on with my life as usual as a Catholic. And that's what I've come to. Business as usual for the Catholic Church is no longer acceptable.
Well, and that includes, you write, going to Mass, even as a layperson. Can you tell me a little bit about that? I mean, that's a radical change in lifestyle for you, I take it.
It's true. As I describe it in this piece, I feel like I'm in a state of fast and abstinence. It's an old Catholic tradition, fasting from food and drink and abstaining from meat. Penitential observances usually associated with Lent. But I've been in fast and abstinence from the Mass itself, from the Eucharist. I've been fortunate in the Catholic communities I've been a part of. The priests I know are men of profound integrity. I regret that what I'm writing is probably wounding to them. But I could no longer go on with the institution itself. I'm calling for such a change in the institution. I'm not leaving it. I'm not renouncing my faith. I'm not walking away from the church. I'm a self-described internal exile in the church now. I understand that I'm actually not alone in this. There are many, many, many Catholics who feel this way, who even act this way. We're simply refusing to treat this as business as usual, which is how the bishops want it to be treated. And we saw that in the document that was released in Rome, I believe week before last, the kind of definitive statement by the Church of Pope Francis about this scandal, which basically is more of the same, business as usual, bishops supervising bishops, no mandated penalties for abusers or for those who cover up abuse.
Do you think there should be mandatory reporting to civil authorities?
That's, absolutely. This document from the Vatican 2 weeks ago requires reports of accused abusers to be forwarded to church authorities, but not to civil authorities. That's a tip-off. That's the church still trying to keep this within the precinct of clerical control. There are many places where priests and clergy are required by law to report, and this document won't prevent that. In fact, it encourages that. But the church itself should be requiring that. The church should be involving lay people in this process. The church should be mandating the removal from ministry permanently of anyone convicted of abusing a minor. None of that is happening. This is more of the same. It's an appalling conclusion of Francis's own grave responsibility to lead us to a new chapter, and it hasn't happened.
So just from a practical standpoint, I mean, if what you're calling for were to ever come true, an abolishment of the priesthood, what then would the church look like?
Well, the church will still organize itself around the memory of Jesus Christ, which is, of course, always tied up with the reading of the Gospels, the reading of the Scriptures, the explicit call to discipleship, to following Jesus, acts of the corporal works of mercy, devotion to justice and peace. All of that around gatherings centered on the meal, the bread and the wine, the Mass, the Eucharist, that will continue.
So who would lead it?
What I'm arguing now is it's time for a new phase in church life. In the beginning, the church was organized around such meals not by ordained clergy, but by the people who gathered in their homes. Hmm. The orders of the church that we see now are not 2,000 years old. Essentially, they're 1,000, 1,800 years old at the most, but the order of the priesthood as we know it is about a millennium old. All I'm really saying is the church has to do now what it has done in the past. In the past, it modeled itself around the Roman Empire. The archdiocese was originally a Roman government structure. The basilica was the palace of the emperor. The church organized itself around the traditions of the Roman Empire. Then it organized itself around the traditions of the monarchy in the Middle Ages. Now it's time for the church to do a version of the same thing. I'm calling for a conservative response, really, and the church could organize itself around the ethos of our era, which is liberal democracy, equality for everybody, and the tip-off is where are women in this, accountability, transparency, and the absolute commitment to the observance of law and the protection of the innocent. These are structures of the church that I'm sure will come into being. Think 100 years from now. 100 years from now, the church will look very different from what it looks like now. And what I'm asking is for people, Catholics, who are appalled by what the authorities in the church have been doing, not to give up on the church, but to work for that new vision, for that new era. How we get there, it's not clear. We won't really know clearly until we're looking back at how things developed and unfolded. It's urgent. We have the great advantage of organizing ourselves forever around the memory of Jesus Christ. We can't let go of it. We want to be worthy of it. And that's been the heart and soul of the church from the beginning, and that's going to be the heart and soul of it going forward.
That's James Carroll. He's a former priest, the author of 20 books, and his new article is To Save the Church, Dismantle the Priesthood. It appears in the June issue of The Atlantic. Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
My privilege. Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, Mayor Marty Walsh joins us to take your calls and to introduce Boston's new school superintendent, Brenda Caselius. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
We know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We're joined now by incoming Boston School Superintendent Brenda Caselius. The school committee voted 5-2 recently to offer her the job over two other finalists, and Caselius served as Minnesota's Education Commissioner from 2011 until January of this year. She's also been a social studies teacher, a diversity coordinator, and an academic superintendent for the Memphis City Schools. Incoming Superintendent Caselius, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Mayor Marty Walsh will join us momentarily. And listeners, we'd like you to chime into this conversation as well. What questions do you have for the mayor and for the new superintendent? You can give us a ring at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. Superintendent, I saw in your official BPS bio that you are a hockey player in whatever spare time you manage to have. Have you found a place to play hockey here in Boston since you've arrived?
Well, I've been looking, and it's 80 degrees outside right now. So
I don't mean outdoors, but is there a league or something that you can get in on?
I hope to be joining a women's league for next winter. Yes, I started playing when I was 42, so I've played for about 9 years now, and it's just a lot of fun to be with the ladies and get out onto the ice and have a good time. Okay. I always say I'm a much better skater than I am stick handler, though.
Well, as one does, you pick up a new hobby. I like that. So to the job at hand, and I should point out that you haven't started yet. You're starting July 1st, but I'm sure that you've been studying up, getting ready, and you've got a lot on your plate. One of them is a lot of facilities plans, right? There's this program called Build BPS that I'm sure you're very familiar with. This is sort of this big master plan to manage the many facilities that you'll have on your watch, and that's just one of the many challenges. So as you think about getting up and running, is that sort of at the top of your list or something else? What do you expect will be some of the big hurdles on your agenda right at the beginning?
Yeah, so Build PPS is a really important opportunity for us to be able to create equitable and rich learning environments in which children learn and which families and communities can enjoy throughout the day. And so I'm very, very excited about the Build BPS. But I think the number one opportunity right in front of me is what I've been doing over the past 2 weeks, and that's building relationships, reestablishing trust, engaging with the community, hearing their hopes and dreams for their children, and really establishing a strong team that can initiate a shared vision that everybody can believe in over the next 13 years.
So who have you been meeting with? I mean, is it teachers? Is it parents? Is it all of the above? What are you doing? And has Boston been friendly to you? We sometimes get the
It's just been an absolute wonderful welcome. You know, I don't believe these stories that everybody says about Boston being a hard place or being very political. Everybody's been very warm. And so I'm hoping that we can turn the page and start telling new stories about Bostonians, the stories that I've been able to hear about hope and about just really their incredible pride in their schools and in their community and the brain trust that's here and the philanthropy that's here and the nonprofits. Just so many people pitching in. And so I think it's really about coherence and about clarity and really dotting the I's and crossing the T's of the partnerships to make sure all kids get what they need to learn. So, yeah, I've had a really warm welcome from Bostonians, and I'm anxious to call it home.
Well, I'm glad to hear that we haven't fulfilled our sometimes chilly reputation. But as you know, I mean, you've heard, I'm sure you've done your homework, and your predecessor, Tommy Chang, was criticized by some parent groups for not making those kinds of overtures that you're describing, that he didn't build those relationships with teacher groups and other stakeholders. How do you overcome that high hurdle? Because I'm sure that when he walked in the door, he was thinking about some of the same things and in some estimations still fell short.
Well, you know, I wasn't here for Tommy, and I'm sure there's some really great things that he did as well. And so, you know, I'm hoping to build on some of those really positive things that he was able to build in terms of a foundation. However, you know, one of the things I'm known for as a strong skill set is really bringing people to the table. And I think that over the past 8 years as Commissioner of Education for the state of Minnesota, it's been imperative in terms of finding bipartisan agreements to be able to compromise and make progress and to move forward. And I think some of that just is in showing up, like I've been doing over the past couple of weeks and plan to do throughout June, to reestablish those relationships and that trust, and being willing to go out and you know, go to church with folks and be in within the community and live within the community and just really do a lot of listening. And so that's just something I enjoy doing. And I think is essential in order to have a shared understanding and a shared vision moving forward.
I mentioned earlier that the school committee voted 5-2 to offer you the job. The school committee in Boston, for folks who don't know, is appointed by the mayor. That was a policy change that went in some decades ago. In some other communities, the school committee is elected. And I mentioned that just to note that there's, you know, a lot of influence at City Hall. You want to be on the same page with the mayor and the school committee that he appoints. So how has that relationship begun for you, and how much autonomy do you think that you'll have to do what you think needs to be done in the school system and not be just directed by City Hall?
Well, yeah, after 8 years of being commissioner, as I said, I really realized that it is not just the in-school factors that impact children and families and their success. It's really, you know, all hands on deck. It's really everybody, the out-of-school factors as well. And so when I was starting to look at what do I want to do next, I wanted to leverage what I had learned over the past 8 years about interagency work and sub-cabinet work to, you know, leverage the human services work, to leverage housing, to leverage, you know, supports for food security and all of those things that we know matter and whether children thrive or not. And so when I selected Boston, I did that because I knew it was mayoral control. And I knew that this mayor in particular was making a large commitment to equity and to ensuring that all Bostonians had an equal opportunity at happiness and a great life and being full contributors to the overall community and their health and wellness. And so that was a big decision for me. And so I'm really looking forward to working with the mayor. I think he will give me a lot of autonomy as well as the school committee in setting the vision, because the vision won't just be mine. It will be that which is shared by all of us. And that's the only way I think that we can move forward.
We're talking with the incoming superintendent of Boston Public Schools, Brenda Caselius. Mayor Marty Walsh will be joining us a little bit later. And we'd like to welcome you to give us a ring as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right. You know that there's going to be questions from parents, of course,
sure,
out to get. And so we have Jim in Roxbury who has a question for us. Go ahead, Jim.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Boston, Dr. Casillas. Boston and Massachusetts have distinguished themselves on the NAEP nationally, but we've lagged along with the rest of the nation in the performance of black students. What ideas will you, and innovations will you be introducing to close the achievement gap of black students in Boston?
Well, thank you for that question. Boston is much like Minnesota in that we have really strong overall performance for all students, but you nailed it right on the head there with, but we still have so much more work to do with black and brown students and ensuring that poor students, students have disabilities and our students who are not yet speaking English proficiency have the kind of supports that they need within school. So I think, you know, part of what is the what matters for that is overall school funding and making sure that all schools are funded equitably, which is really important. The mayor and his commitment to early childhood and getting the first 1,000 days of a child's life, where that's so important to a child's brain development and to their overall well-being. And then also looking at getting and ensuring all schools have high-quality, competent, and caring teachers within them and a strong school leader. I think that is also very important. And then also making sure that there are rigorous offerings within schools and that those standards are aligned to the assessments. You know, you may already know, since you mentioned the National Assessment for Educational Progress, often known as the NAEP, is an indicator that's national and is not directly aligned to the standards in Massachusetts. So it's really looking very closely at what the standards are, what's expected for children, and what then is assessed, and making sure that our teachers understand the level of depth that's required for students to show proficiency on those exams. So that's kind of where I would start. And then just finally, I already talked a lot about parent engagement and family supports, and that's going to be critical. So I really do support the idea of hub schools, full-service community schools, and making sure that we look at children holistically within a family unit.
Mayor Marty Walsh is joining us now. Hello, Mr. Mayor.
How are you?
Excellent. Glad to have you
alongside. I'm not sure I can add to this conversation.
Well, you know, we're glad to have the two of you, though, because as we were talking about earlier, there is this important relationship between City Hall and the school system. And Brenda Casillas was telling us moments ago that one of the things that actually drew her to Boston was the mayor-appointed city council. She feels like there's a certain accountability that goes to that structure. But you know not everybody feels that way. So why do you
but
like
I do
that
think,
system?
I think, first of all, just to deal with that, I think it was voted on twice. 70% of Bostonians want an appointed school committee.
And why do you think that is? I mean, what do you think the draw
is? Well, to get the politics out of it. I remember when the school committee was elected, and I was a 21-year-old kid thinking I wanted to run for school committee to get my foot in politics and run for state representative someday. And I think that that's one of the challenges I think you have. And I talked to my colleagues around the country, and they're envious of the Boston style. They thought, we love what you have going on in Boston to be able to do that. I think that that's key. Also, I mean, we have some real challenges ahead of us, and to try and get the – it's still a political conversations, obviously, because you have an appointed committee that have very different backgrounds and very different educational experiences they're bringing to the table. And having them really be engaged in the process is so important, because when you – you know, as you select who goes on there, I mean, in under the my selections, if you will, diverse, the most diverse ever, making sure they have specialized in different areas of education, parents, non-parents, you know, former parents over the time of my time as mayor, former parents of former BPS students, I should say. So I think a lot of that plays into effect as well. But, you know, I think the relationship is key. I mean, I think the relationship that we have, the superintendent has with the mayor's office is important. The relationship with the school committee is really important, and the relationship with the community is really important. I think that all of those different pieces are important to move our district forward.
How hands-on will you be with the new superintendent?
Everyone asked that question. Yeah. You know, there was an editorial about a year and a half ago saying that I should be more hands-on. There was an editorial a year ago in the same paper, I shouldn't be hands-on. You have to be hands-on to the point where you're just making sure moving the district forward in a supporting role. You know, when it comes to the process of educating a kid, and Brenda I came at just at the tail end of what she just said, listening to her talk about whether it's inclusion or ELL or SPED. I mean, those aren't my expertise areas. And I'm not going to sit down and tell the superintendent that, geez, I think you're really heading down the wrong direction when it comes to ELL, and I think you really should think of this. I want to be able to be supportive of her in the case of raising money for the district from the philanthropic community. I want to be supportive of her when we create capital budgets to build new schools in the city of Boston. I want to be supportive of her when she needs support from whatever the mayor's office can help in supporting. I don't get hands-on with making the day-to-day decisions. I don't get hands-on. I mean, obviously, if we're going to, change bus times for schools or close a school, I need to know.
Is there any history of that?
Did that happen recently? Yeah. But I need to know that. And I need to just be able to say on the political side, have we vetted it? Have we thought about it? Are we doing the right thing? Is this the right approach? Do parents know? How's it going to affect our kids? I mean, questions like that I'm going to ask like any other person would ask. There is a separation. And I don't micromanage any of my departments in city government. I mean, if you can ask, you bring any department head in here or any cabinet person in here, I'm not micromanaging the police department, how to run the police department. I'm not micromanaging the fire department, how to run the fire department on housing or BPDA. I just don't do that. I mean, I'm more of a person that runs a city that really you have people in place that can do the job. And if they can't do the job, then change it. Because if I'm doing the job of all those different pieces, then I'm not focused on what I should be as mayor of the city of Boston moving it forward.
We're talking about education with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh and the incoming Superintendent of Schools, Brenda Caselius. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can also ring up the mayor for, non-education related questions. He can handle it. But in the meantime, Dee is calling from West Roxbury. She's got an education related question. What's on your mind, Dee?
Yes, I'm working at the Urban Science Academy in West Roxbury, which is closing in June.
Yes.
And I feel like the way that it was handled, and the kids are feeling displaced, teachers are feeling unsupported, teachers have been there like 20 years, all of a sudden have to, job hunt for the first time in 20 years. And I'm just wondering if we can look at a different way of how to handle when schools are being considered closing and giving people more notice and maybe not just telling teachers, okay, now you got to find a new job, but helping them in a more direct way.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying, and I'll give an example. This year at the school committee meeting, Urban Science Academy is one school, and the other school is the McCormick School, and two very different situations. The McCormick School working on how do we make sure that as we move back into the McCormick School, keep trying to keep the parents, not the parents, but the teachers in the same kind of cluster working with Excel High School in South Boston. Urban Science Academy, unfortunately, it became a structural issue. I mean, I think you know that. I mean, it became an issue. Here we are, a building that was, I guess you would say, built 30 years ago, fairly new in the terms of Boston, that was having a structural problem. And part of what we're having in the school department is we have two-thirds of our buildings were built prior to World War II. Another third of our buildings were built after that, obviously, but we have buildings that were built in the 70s that aren't as strong as the ones that were built in the 30s and 40s. So we have some issues there. So that's kind of what happened there. And I know that the superintendent, Laura Perel, has worked in working with the students and working with the teachers and trying to create opportunities for our young people that as the juniors go into senior year, I think they're working to try and keep everyone together. It's just a very difficult situation. We have a very similar situation that's festering right now in Brighton. With the Jackson Man, where we're making some temporary upgrades to the school and hopefully going to get 2 to 3 years out of the school. And we have to start laying down a foundation now what we do here with that school out there. And we don't have a lot of swing space. We don't have a lot of places that we can put our kids. If we had to do a major renovation, we had to close the school down. That's all of these challenges are part of what we initially started having conversation around. Build BPS, which is the plan to build new schools in Boston and renovate the old ones. So we are in the midst of it, but we're talking literally decades of not paying any attention to the physical plants in our city. And that's the issue with Urban Science Academy's building. It's not the program, it's the building of Urban Science Academy and also West Roxbury.
But Brenda Caselius, let me ask you a little bit about sort of the, I guess you'd call it the soft skills that go with this kind of facilities management that the mayor is talking about. I mean, Mayor, you lay out a very logical case for why it may be necessary to take a building offline after a long period of time. But I think as we heard from Dee, who is a teacher, there's a real emotional attachment for faculty, students, families, and neighborhoods.
I think it's not a fair question for Brenda because we're talking about buildings, 125 buildings in Boston, two-thirds of them were built prior to World War II, and a third of them built after that. And now we have a superintendent coming in. We have a plan in place on how we're going to move forward. But we're talking about decades of not paying attention and not upgrading our buildings. And I think she's going to inherit, obviously, I don't mean to speak for you, but she's going to inherit a whole bunch of problems of buildings that parents might be attached to, but our kids aren't learning in 21st century learning. And I think that this is where we talked about this with the superintendent, with Brenda, is that, you know, as we think about schools and what they're going to look like in the future, they might look different.
But I think the question, though, is how you manage it, right? If you're the superintendent, and this very much will be your problem, which is why I'm asking you about it, is you're the one who has to manage that transition and get buy-in from those families and those teachers, right? So how do you do that?
Well, you have you're transparent, right? And you come out there and you talk about the plan and you look at the plan. It's part of a overall strategic plan. And I think what Boston Public Schools is really going to be looking forward to do is to work with the community on a strategic plan. Build PPS will be only part of that. They're also looking to have high quality schools in every neighborhood. What's the plan for that? And they'll help define that. So teachers, parents will all be part of that discussion. And we're going to start that right away once school starts. And I'm going to get out into every school within the first 100 days and talk with folks. And then I'm going to have town hall meetings and hear from them. And then we'll start developing the strategic plan, which then will then direct the Build PPS and work with the Build PPS as we look at future projects.
1-800-423-8255 is the number if you'd like to join. 1-800-423-TALK. And Steve is calling from Dorchester. What are you wondering about, Steve?
Hi, how are you? And thanks for having my call.
Glad to have you. What are you wondering?
Well, I'm wondering why there's not an emphasis on trade schools in the city. As a father of a couple who have licenses in the trades and who do very well, and there's a building boom going on, and it's going to be for a long time, I believe. Why aren't trade schools on the table at all?
So that's a really good question, and there is so much need for trades and vocation. We have a number of trade schools, but I do think that there's a way to have more programming in our schools around career pathways, around working with our business community to look at those skills, whether they're soft skills or real high-skilled opportunities to get into these high-skilled jobs, whether it's computer science or biomedical fields or health science fields or what have you. And so we're going to be looking at that. Part of what I've heard from the search committee, as well as all of the folks that I've been talking to over the past 2 weeks, is a lot of emphasis on high schools and looking at our secondary schools, especially with the mayor's Build PPS plan and looking at the reconfiguration of our schools and having elementaries and then also our secondary schools. So that will be part of the discussion. Would love to have you be part of that in the future.
Is that related at all, by the way, to your criticism during your interview process of some of the standardized testing emphasis that you mentioned earlier in our conversation today, too? I mean, that if we fixate too much on whether it's MCAS or exam school tests, that maybe we aren't building the skills that kids who want to go down a different career path that may not lead to college want to go down.
Well, you know, I don't think that assessment necessarily dictates program. I do think that we need to be looking at the programs that we offer simply because we need to be looking at workforce and workforce development. And we need to look to our business community to share with us those needs and what's on the horizon for the jobs in Boston and make sure that our kids are prepared for those.
This must be something you think about a lot, Mr. Mayor. I mean, you've got a broader view, right? And you're thinking about the workforce development pumping those people out.
Just to Steve's point earlier, Boston years ago in the 60s and 70s had shop as one of the classes in almost every school in Boston, every high school. And then somewhere along the road, somebody made the decision, the school committee made the decision to create Madison Park, and they did. And that became our one school for all of technical education. And I think that, you know, we launched a couple of years ago putting our kids on a pathway to a career or school or college. And I think that that's something we have to do more of. I went out to Worcester VoTech a couple weeks ago. And they have an incredible program out there. They have a nursing program, veterinary program. They have a mechanical program. And I think that, you know, working with the new superintendent and really focusing on the jobs of currently in front of us, not every young person is designed for college, but every young person should be prepared for college if they choose to go. So we have work to do. And this isn't just a Boston problem. This is a national high school problem, I think, of not preparing our kids enough for the workforce of today. And I think that, you know, as we move forward here, I'm looking forward to working with the superintendent on the plans that she creates and then supporting those as she moves forward.
So we're talking about integrating trade skills into the school system.
And
tech skills. And Jennifer in Brighton is wondering about another skill set. Jennifer, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes, good afternoon. I'm wondering how the arts are going to be incorporated into BPS to keep the education thriving and alive and the schools, you know, top notch.
Well, this is an area I think that Superintendent Perrell has really focused on and done just some outstanding work with increasing arts within the schools. But also we need to, take it to another level and just make sure all children have the opportunity for art expression. My own daughter is becoming an art teacher, which I'm just super thrilled about. And so I'm hoping that we'll be able to have that be part of our strategic plan, because it's through the arts and through cultural experiences, language and culture and the arts, as well as these vocational experiences that create rich opportunities for children to be connected to school and to be connected to their peers and adults and others within the community. And so looking at all kinds of well-rounded, holistic opportunities for children in athletics and well-being, things that we put in place at the schools.
Yeah, we've just changed the way we do arts in Boston, creating the arts cabinet in the city in 2014. We're very engaged now. And I mean, I want Boston to be an arts leader in the world, not just in Massachusetts or the United States. I want us to be an arts leader in the world. And I think it's so important, Jennifer, that we get the arts more into the schools. We're building a brand new Boston Arts Academy right now. It'll be the premier arts high school in the country. That's one school focused on the arts. But it is important for us that all of our young people get exposed to arts in their school and classrooms.
Just a reminder, you can feel free to chime in with a question that's not related to education. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael is in West Roxbury. Michael, what are you wondering?
Hello, Mayor and Superintendent. I'm wondering if you would take up my air conditioning challenge. Since most of our schools don't have air conditioning in the summer, which today was a nice hot day, as the hot days roll on, will you guys voluntarily turn off the air conditioning in City Hall and Bowling Building until all of our school and children have air conditioning?
Mike, are you a teacher, Mike, in the school?
I am.
Yeah, you did that. You actually challenged me on Twitter last year to shut it down. And ironically, when you challenged me, our air conditioning was broken in City Hall. I'm just telling you, it was broken for a week. And I think again, Mike, to your point, you've taught in the district for a long time, I think, and you certainly know the buildings are old, and we don't have 21st century buildings, we don't have 21st century mechanicals, we don't have 21st century cooling systems. In some cases, we probably have 19th century. Open the window, and those are some of the.
Unfortunately, the windows should have been designed to lift up. But the design now is the windows tilt in and there's no cross breeze.
Yeah,
it's a sauna in these rooms.
Yeah, no, and I understand that, and I know, and in the wintertime, I mean, the heat's on because you just never. I mean, we had a. It might be a hot day today, but it was a cold day, I think, a week ago today. So it was, you know, we're turning heat on, turning heat off. And that's part of all the need to really fast track a lot of these upgrades in our schools, whether it's the old existing schools. How do we bring in new mechanicals in there so that our kids are in learning in a comfortable environment? And then the new schools, obviously, we're working on it. Except, ironically, when they designed the Elliott School, the new Elliott School doesn't have air conditioning. This was designed prior to my administration. For some reason, they didn't put air conditioning in the I have no idea why. And we're trying to resolve that issue. But the new schools that we're building will have proper heating, proper air conditioning, proper ventilation. But we are challenged again with the old school old buildings.
Have you found out, Brenda Casellius, whether your office has air conditioning?
No, she hasn't had a hot day yet. Wait till next week.
Start in July. So.
I'm from Minnesota, so we have the same problem in Minneapolis Public Schools with some old buildings that don't have air, and especially even in rural Minnesota. And so, yeah, it's an issue in these colder environments.
Let me just turn for a moment to a slightly more serious subject, which is the achievement gap in Boston public schools between white and Asian students and black and Latino students. And it depends on the metric you use, but if you go by the MCAS, for example, last year, only about a quarter of black and Hispanic students in grades 3 through 8 scored above grade level proficiency in reading, compared to more than 60% of white and Asian students. So that is a big gap. What's your plan to tackle that? I mean, this is a longstanding problem in a lot of school districts, but what are you thinking about as you come into Boston?
Yeah, well, thanks. I did answer that already with the previous phone call, but I can certainly talk a little bit more about, you know, early childhood initiatives, making sure you support the family, making sure that you have high-quality teachers and caring, competent teachers in every single classroom, that they have the supports to actually meet the expectations of what we're asking them to do, that they have a strong leader within the school building. So those are some of the parts. And then, of course, the holistic pieces, kids feel connected, dealing with mental health issues and trauma-informed instruction, and that, you know, teachers, they have support with counselors and social workers and that kind of thing. And so, you know, those are the key pieces that really impact whether children succeed or not. And then, you know, getting the mayor's help, like he said, with philanthropic community for summer gap stuff that we did today with the 10 years of summer learning and celebrating today the 10 years anniversary of that. So those are the pieces so that you can close the achievement gap, the achievement slide in the summer. So those are some of the pieces that we'll be working on with parents and with the community.
And just so people know, today we launched Fifth Quarter, which is a summer learning program. We did it last year. 2 years ago, we started it in 2015, 3 years ago now. Oh, yeah, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, actually. We started with 10,000 kids, 100 nonprofits. We have 160 nonprofits now helping us and going to 14,000 kids. And this is where, you know, when kids not graduate, but when they end the school year, they go into summer learning programs at Franklin Park Zoo, at Blue Hills and other places. And that's a key. And then we also launched Universal Pre-Kindergarten. I'm not sure if you talked about that yet. But that's, you know, as Brenda mentioned, a strong start in a four-year-old's life is very important. And having those extra opportunities for parents to be able to have extended learning is important. So I think that we just have to continue to create opportunities and try and get as much education into the house as we can. What does that mean in the classroom, in the house, after school, when the summers as well?
And one other thing is, when I was commissioner, I was able to go and visit schools all the time. And so I was able to see excellence in where it was happening. I actually visited 44 four- and five-time award-winning schools. They were schools that for 5 years had always landed in the top 15%. And I went out and visited them, talked to teachers and said, what is it and how are you getting these great results every single year? And they said, we feel like a family. And so one of the core values that I'm bringing with me for transition is that we need to have joyful learning environments for teachers and students and families. And I think that that is really important. And I do believe that there's one other piece. And so you mentioned the test scores. And there is a gap between the standards and the assessments. And I don't think teachers have had the level of professional development. I'm still trying to understand here in Massachusetts, but this is very much true in Minnesota and is across the nation, that with the Common Core and with the new standards, teachers are still unpacking that in terms of the much harder level of assessments that are being given right now. So really working with teachers on understanding the assessments, how assessments are made, what is actually expected for children to score proficient in those assessments, and then what they have to do in their classroom in terms of the learning and the teaching. So we'll be working on that and have a real tight focus on curriculum, instruction, standards, and assessment.
Mayor Walsh, let me just hit a couple of other topics that are somewhat related to schools, but maybe only tangentially. I'm thinking about the Trust Act in Boston, which is a local ordinance that allows police to ignore a request from federal immigration authorities to detain an unauthorized immigrant unless that person is wanted for a separate crime. What's the state of that in your mind? Is it strong enough?
Working right now with Councilor Zakim to strengthen that. Obviously, we had one case in 2015 that came to light, and we're working on it. But I think the real important piece is the working with the Boston Police Department and making sure that you know, we understand that immigrants are part of our city, and that, you know, if there's a serious crime and the federal government's looking for assistance, we will work on a very serious crime. But as far as, you know, some of this misdemeanor stuff, we're not.
This one case, I assume you're talking about the Honduran immigrant, yes, right, who was detained and ultimately deported.
Yeah,
and
those other
cases.
Those other things, they were workers' comp, allegedly fraudulent workers' comp claim and all that stuff.
So what's the status of that internal review at BPD? Is the detective is still on the job, dismissed?
On the job. He's still on the job.
Is that concluded?
It was reviewed back in 2017.
And that's the end of it?
Yeah.
Okay. And let me ask you, too, about some news that came over the wire on Friday afternoon that certainly surprised me about next door in Everett, the casino that Wynn Resorts just spent $2.5 billion to build, possibly being on the block with MGM as a possible suitor. Yeah, what was your reaction?
I don't know. I wasn't overly surprised.
Really?
I still think we've been trying to track it down to see how much is it really an issue? Is that potentially going to happen? I know the news reported on it, but there's been no follow up. We're looking at what the impacts would be for Boston. I'm under this understanding that if a new operator came in, we would have to go back to the table and create a new surrounding community agreement with them and work that out. So I think the casino is going to open in Everett, and just not sure whose name's going to be on the top of it. It seems like it's going to open with Wynn with Wonkar on the top, I guess. But it does definitely seem you don't let a rumor like that out if it's not true.
All right. Keep the lightning round going here. One more at least. Pot shops in Boston. Where are they? Everybody's wondering.
Go ask the state.
Ask the state. Is it really all on them, or is there anything you can do at the city level to move it along?
They have 9 applications up there right now, and we'll wait. You know, there's a process that goes through here that we go through the city of Boston and go through the zoning commission and the zoning committee, and then we put it up to the state. So I was asked the question the other day by an applicant, where's my license? I'm like, well, where is it? He says at the state. Well, you have to contact the state because we've done our part.
All right. That's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Thank you, as always, for your time and for taking our calls.
Thank you.
Also joining us is incoming Boston School Superintendent Brenda Caselius. Thank you so much for your time today as well, and welcome to Boston.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, and Paris Alston. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.